So I'm delighted tonight, guys, to be joined by a patient organisation's representation or representatives, even in the form of Rare or Inflammatory Conditions Community UK or RACC UK. And joining me is Rachel Rimmer, who is the director of RACC, and Mark Telkman, who is the patient engagement officer. How are you doing, guys?
Hello.
Good. Hi. How you doing, Joe?
Yeah, we're good. I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm much better than I was last week when I was trying to do these events. I feel a lot more energy now after having a relaxing weekend. So thank you for giving up your time on a Sunday evening. I really do appreciate it, and I hope it's not too inconvenient for you guys. Obviously, for the regulars, they would have known that we've already spoke together when we've done the AI arthritis 24-hour marathon stream. You probably didn't get the best of me then, as I was on a 10-hour hosting stint. But for people that maybe weren't with us that day or haven't come across you, can you just maybe give a quick introduction about who you are and what your role is with the organisation? Maybe starting with yourself, Rachel?
Yeah, so I'm Rachel. I'm a patient with MKD, mevalonate kinase deficiency, and I'm one of the co-founders of the charity, because there wasn't any support in the UK for patients with these rare conditions, and not a lot of advocacy was being done internationally. It was quite hard because of the different healthcare systems, so I took it upon myself to kickstart something. We started from a Facebook group to begin with, and then that was 2017, and by 2019 we got charity status. So it's been a lot of work, but it's really enjoyable, and I'm glad to see one familiar face in the chat, so that's nice. Hi, Pam.
that's brilliant, and I'm definitely going to dig more into that and how that came about, so thank you, Rachel. I really appreciate it. And Mark, do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and your role with the organisation?
Yeah, so as Joel said, my name is Mark Telkman. I joined RAC about almost a year ago. I think it was like February, March last year. Time goes quickly. I'm the patient engagement officer, so I kind of just looking for a volunteer role just generally, and came across RAC firstly through a leaflet, I think, in the Headington Hospital, where I'm, because I, like Joel, I have a type of arthritis, so I'm there fairly regularly. And then online, just looking for volunteer roles, came across RAC and got in touch with Rachel, and she was very keen to have me. So, yeah, been about a year now.
And we're not letting him go.
No. Well, I know from my interactions with you, Mark, you obviously offer a lot of value there, because it's always been a pleasure interacting with you. So thank you for sharing, guys. I really appreciate that. And I feel like maybe before we get into the formation of the organisation, because Rachel, I've got lots of questions there, especially from the Facebook roots and everything. I find that really interesting. Continue maybe, if you don't mind, sharing a little bit more about your condition. And also what I'd really like to get across for the audience as well, as how sort of auto-inflammatory conditions might differ from autoimmune, because that's obviously a word that's used regularly on this show. So I think it's really important if we can maybe get that distinction as well.
Okay, so I'll try not to be too scientific so that the audience can understand it a bit better. To begin with, autoimmune conditions are involved with the adaptive immune system. We have two parts of the immune system. Autoinflammatory is involved in the innate immune system. So that's something where you've got either a genetic disposition of something, and a lot of the conditions are diagnosed with genetic testing. However, some haven't been diagnosed with genetic testing, and it requires really specialist care. And there's a lot of similarities between the two. So when a patient does turn up to A&E with a crisis, as an autoimmune patient may do, you know, the autoinflammatory aspect, because they're so rare, isn't even considered in the treatment pathway, in how to deal with the crisis. So it's complicated, but the top sort of symptoms that patients would necessarily suffer from before they reach diagnosis is fevers, joint swelling, organ swelling of sort, kidneys, liver, spleen, abdominal pain, rashes, and they can be all together, or some flares can be just a couple of symptoms at a time. And yeah, there's no two patients the same, even within the 32 conditions that we cover. So my experience of MKD, methylate kinase deficiency, is not necessarily the same as another patient. And just to reiterate how rare they are, that we're like 400 people worldwide that's been diagnosed with just methylate kinase deficiency. So we're rare. I think for us, doing the work, the advocacy work through the charity, having a platform like this and being given the opportunity to get ourselves out there and help to raise awareness is really important, particularly because of the difficulties between autoimmune and autoinflammatory. So we welcome this opportunity very much. So we're very grateful.
Yeah, you do really important work, and it's such a sort of gap as well. And I think we see lots of like the big hitting sort of conditions, you know, the vastly the ones that affect large numbers. So anything I can do to help the smaller guys that are doing the niche stuff, I'm more than happy to. Could you maybe, and I'm conscious, Mark, you're going to be waiting patiently here, but I will bring you back in. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about your specific condition in terms of like how it onset, like, because I think you had it from very young, if not birth, but yeah, could you maybe explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so my mum would probably say that she knew I was trouble when I was born, because I was born with jaundice. I had a fever, and they were some babies do get sick when they're first born, but I wasn't showing any real signs of improvement, and I kept getting these rashes, and they were worried that I might be having an allergic reaction to something. And they were asking my parents things like, have you changed the washing powder? Has she eaten something that she doesn't normally eat? You know, all of those generalized things that I considered. And my parents were just at a loss. I'm now 37. So I've got 37 years experience in this. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 16 years old. So there was a bit of an inclination from when I was about 8 years old that I could have this rare condition. But unfortunately, the genetic testing at the time wasn't available in the UK.
Right, okay.
So when I was 16, I gave consent for a skin biopsy to be taken, and that had to be shipped over to the Netherlands for research and testing. And it was there where they diagnosed me with methylate kinase deficiency.
Wow.
And then 2 weeks before my GCSE exams started, I got a letter through the post to say that this is what I've got, this is my diagnosis. I was like, okay, that's great. They know what I've got now. And then everything changed again, because they didn't know how to treat it. They didn't know what they were dealing with over here. Worldwide, they weren't very sure. So it was horrible timing. My mental health spiraled. I did a lot of my GCSE exams in hospital as well as in school. I ended up retake my English the year after as a catch-up year, so it had a significant knock-on effect to my education. And then I did 2 extra years in sixth form to get 2 A-levels, and all my friends at that time were applying to go to university. I applied, and I wanted to do paediatric nursing, because I knew that I had the experience as a child to be able to make a difference to other children. And unfortunately, it was my health that let me down in that area. So a lot of my peers were off at uni doing midwifery or nursing, and I was left behind. And
that must have a significant effect on your mental health and everything.
Yeah, definitely. I had a pretty bad breakdown, to be honest. I've got family near where I live at the moment, and they reached out to me and said, well, why don't you come down and just, you know, have some time out? And they helped me get a place to live. And then a year later, I applied to go to university again to do early childhood studies, and I got an unconditional offer.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I had to do that part-time because of my health. And then I graduated in 2014, had a fantastic role in the Students' Union, had a year of experience that I could never dream of. Hard work because of health, but I loved it. And then I thought, right, okay, now it's career time. Let's focus on me doing my career. So I went and got a job in a nursery with a lot of children, with a lot of bugs, and 2 weeks in, I was off. And eventually, after 2 months, the nursery, I could not fault them. They tried everything. We changed my roles, my responsibilities, the age in which I was caring for the children, from babies to older children, more independent. It just wasn't working. I was even put on admin days if I wasn't feeling well. So I had to make the heartbreaking decision to come out of work and get myself back on track. And then that's when I started up the support group, really. So,
before we get on to that, I just want to ask, has that situation changed in terms of testing in the UK? Is that the path to diagnosis shortened for your particular condition, or how does that look now compared to when you were 16?
So I did have hope. I did have hope because we know of some children within the UK that have been diagnosed, and I think one of them has had stem cell treatment quite early on in their life, which has been a positive change for them. But then the other week, somebody out of the blue, I think they were in their 30s, said, oh, I've just recently been diagnosed. And I'm like, oh. So, yeah, it's you have high hopes. And then I think because there's this revolving door that patients have to go through, and a lot of it that we seem to be doing is educating them to monitor their symptoms and evidence their symptoms to be able to support referrals. And then they'll see a GP and they're like, well, we've never heard of this these conditions before. And we're not necessarily saying to the GP, you need to diagnose us, but please refer us to a specialist or specialist area that may know more or have the contacts.
Yeah.
So I think the 100,000 Genome Project that the NHS and Genomics England took place 2017, I think it was. I think we saw quite an influx of patients come out from that, children particularly. I think COVID, and I didn't want to really have to say this, but because everyone's tired of COVID.
But it still comes up nearly every show because of the nature of what we live with it. And long-term health conditions and all that.
But I think COVID was an interesting time because a lot of parents are told that, you know, they'll take the child to the doctors and they'll GP might say, oh, it's just a viral infection, all kids get sick. And then you go home and they're no better and you end up taking them back, and then it's developed into some bacterial infection, they're on antibiotics. And it was just a vicious cycle. But a lot of families through COVID were sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, they've not been, you know, mingling with their usual nursery or school, and how are they picking up these infections then? And I think a lot of the families at that point were like, actually, do you know what, something else is going on here and it needs to be investigated. And they saw the referrals being accessed. I know there's a huge backlog, but that the awareness and the knowledge that those conditions, you know, the symptoms were still present, and it was impossible for this child, these children, to have an infection. So why are they getting partner? The symptoms are the same, the fevers, the rashes, the colds, the sore throats. So yeah, we saw an influx through the pandemic, and some of them now are still waiting for genetic testing, but we're getting there slowly.
Yeah, that's it's unfortunate, because what was such a horrible experience for so many of us with conditions during that time, at least now I suppose we're far enough through it that we can start to see, you know, for me personally, it was the first time I felt that people understood how I can get infections really easily, because up until that point, nobody really got it. And they'd just say, well, are you taking the medication then? And so that people have got a little bit more aware. So there was some good, I suppose, to come out of it. I'm conscious that Mark has been waiting really patiently, and I will come back, Rachel, but I maybe, Mark, I haven't asked you if you want to share anything regarding your health condition, but is that something you're comfortable with?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, go for it.
I know it's probably not related to what RAC does, but just maybe just as a bit of a, so I can bring you in and hear a little bit about your story before we ask them why you joined the organisation. So, yeah, I know you have a type of arthritis. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I have a type of arthritis similar to Joel's called axial spondyloarthritis. It's part of an umbrella of diseases that encompasses AS, as I said, psoriatic arthritis, reactive arthritis, uveitis, Crohn's, etc., psoriasis, a few things. So it's difficult to say when it started. I've not lived with it all my life. It's only really been an issue for the last 5, 6, 7 years. I had reactive arthritis when I was 15, sort of coming from a stomach infection, probably food poisoning. And then kind of that went away, and I was like, oh, okay, that happened, whatever, came back a couple times, no biggie. Developed sort of groin and back pain, sort of 17, yeah. 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Again, kind of dismissed it as sporting injuries. Yeah, I can see you nodding your head.
Yeah, I did.
yeah. And then, yeah, it kind of got worse. Kept thinking it was me who was the problem. Misdiagnosed a few times. Got diagnosed with like a slip disc or like a herniated disc being the problem of my back pain. It was kind of when I moved to Oxford, actually, or near Oxford, sort of 5 years ago, that things really flared up. And then I got a bout of uveitis, which is inflammation of the sort of central layer of your eye. It got quite serious, and then they put two and two together of that and my back pain, got a genetic test, and yeah, kind of went from there, got diagnosed with AS. I've had flare-ups, I've had fibromyalgia on top. I take immunosuppressants, anti-inflammatories, pain tablets, all sorts. So and yeah, it kind of leaves me where I am at the moment.
I think the interesting bit there, as you said, the test, that's going to be the HL, whatever it is. I can never remember the code for AS, but yeah, that's really frustrating, because the amount of people that get that done. So I was diagnosed with AS at 14, only to have that test in my mid-20s to find it negative, and I had psoriatic arthritis. And it works both ways, you know what I mean? So if you'd have had that test a lot earlier, that would have probably narrowed it in on actual sort of disease. And yeah, so yeah, thank you for sharing that. I know it's a curveball, so big thank you to her. Get reminded, guys, anyone watching this or listening to it back, that we don't have any pre-prepared questions. This tends to be just a bit of a coffee shop chat. So thank you, Mark, for sharing that. I appreciate it, because I know you weren't expecting it. But what the reason I was asking is I wanted to know if, like, do you think it was like that lived experience that led to you wanting to work with like an organization like RAC or get involved with that sort of thing, or did that happen to be just a totally different thing?
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, like when I first thought about volunteering, it was kind of around the mental health side of things. I've been involved with it at uni, and then obviously living with a painful chronic condition, the whole mental health side encompasses into that. So that's where I was looking originally, looking at sort of cafes and things like that. But just, I came across RAC, and I went, and they found an advert that said they were looking for people, and I went, oh, okay, that weirdly suits me. So, and I was already writing a blog myself at that time and trying to encourage people to write about their own conditions. So yeah, it kind of just, everything fit together. And very thankfully, Rachel gave me the opportunity to help out.
Brilliant. And I suppose, yeah, Rachel, we really need to hear about how this went from Facebook group or onto, you know, a formal organization. I feel like there must be a good story there. So first of all, what made you take to sort of social media, and then how did it sort of end up where we are today?
Well, social media was more of I was curious to find someone with my condition. And there were other organisations that were international. I'm not going to name them because... So I was linked to them, and I was able to find people from other countries with my condition, and that was great. And it was that feeling of I'm actually not alone here. There are people like me out there. And then one of my treatments, because it wasn't necessarily licensed for my condition, it was an off-label drug. It had to go up for an independent funding review, and it got rejected, and we had to go to an appeal, and it just caused so many problems. And I was just so fed up. One, my career had to change because of my health. Two, we can't get access to the medications. Three, patients feel so isolated. Let's do something about this. Something has to change. And if nobody else is willing to do it, then I will. So, yeah, I set up the Facebook group. And it's changed since it's originally started. There were a lot of issues to begin with. And then we had a sort of a different direction in 2018, refreshed. I networked with quite a lot of other organisations within the rare disease community, and I found two really good trustees. Actually, one of them was my friend, who was a primary school teacher at the time, which was hard on her, as you can imagine. So, yeah, they really helped to, you know, support me in getting the organisation off the ground. And then we've had other trustees that have come in. Some haven't got that association to the rare diseases, but they've brought their skill set to the organisation, which I'm probably lack. I'm not a business orientated person in any way. I just want to be there with the patients. There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, trying to keep things ticking over. A lot of regulations with the Charity Commission. And then just as we were getting charity status, we had been contacted as an NHS stakeholder for a drug consultation proposal that had come up. And because we were the only organisation seen to represent this cohort of patients, we were asked to participate. And it was at that point, it was like a trial period for the NHS and NICE, who... NICE are the National Institution of Care Excellence, I think it is.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. and they developed the guidelines for drugs and the policies. And what I noticed was that they were asking for patient experience, but they weren't sure how. So what I was trying to educate them about how to ask us or other groups for patient experience, and then how we can help them to be able to then get the funding approved for these drugs. And we've done 5 drug policies now in the time that we've been, not just as a registered charity, but a couple before then. And only one of them got rejected first time round because that was down to costings. There wasn't enough money left in the budget for that year, so it went back round to the next year. I added more, and that was a bit complicated, that one, because I had to also declare my conflict of interest as a patient.
Yeah.
And I was personally going to benefit from it, so there's that declaration there. But the second time around, we fortunately got, you know, this funding, and I started the drug during the pandemic because I'd had sepsis 2 years before that, and recovering from sepsis was a turbulent time. The 2 years after, and I wasn't working at the time. I was away on holiday with friends when I got ill, and I got stuck in hospital over there. which was fun.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But you know what? It was in Norway. Their healthcare system is amazing.
Yeah. I haven't heard a bad thing about Scandinavian healthcare system.
It was like a 5-star hotel. The beautiful views of the mountains in the background, fresh fruit and fresh salad on your plate, and like, what is this?
But then when you think about how much extortionate fees people like you and I have to pay extra on our travel insurance, then, you know, that's what you deserve.
Yeah. But, yeah, I was lucky. So it was those experiences then that really pushed me forward to these drug policies. And, you know, the medical professionals started reaching out to me and saying, would you support this work? Would you support that work? And, you know, one of them was for... So the National Centre in London that most patients in the UK will go to, there's one in Leeds as well. A lot of children will transfer from Great Ormond Street over to the London Centre, which I did, and it was a horrible transition of care at the time. So we work quite closely with them, both London, Leeds, Sheffield, Bristol, Birmingham, Cambridge now, Newcastle. So we're really trying to branch out, and I'm conscious that a lot of our work is focused in England.
Yeah.
And Wales has a whole different issue of itself because the rheumatology infrastructure isn't there. So it's getting a rheumatologist to see a patient is the key issue in Wales. Before they've even got off the ground for genetic testing, blood testing, all the rest of it.
Yeah, I suppose that's all those specialties people get sent through before you get to the sort of rare, sort of niche stuff, I guess.
Yeah. So, and obviously the main centres in England have their own, like, policy as to how they take patients on. And 9 times out of 10, it won't come directly from a GP. Yeah. Unless they've done the relevant tests and can evidence it. So yeah, and Scotland is another one. We have got patients based in Scotland. We are more than willing to be able to help patients in Scotland, but we're not registered there.
Yeah.
We don't have the networks as such that we do in England. But yeah, we're never turn a patient away. We get influx of patients from outside the UK sometimes wanting help. I think we've had one in Norway, one in Denmark, and they're saying, we don't have anything like this. Where do I go for support? And then for me, there's that language barrier. So then I have to reach out to an international organisation, get an interpreter.
And the thing is, I think because we get a lot of those messages, and we're not even an organization, we just try to signpost. But I think if you're made of that stuff that sort of ends you up in this area, like we're all ended up, it's like you have to try and help somehow. That's the challenge, isn't it? It's like, you know, you have to try and signpost somehow, even if they're not even in your sort of like wheelhouse to do that. So I suppose, like, from you going from Facebook to registered charity, there must have been like a community, an effort there in terms of like people wanting you to do that. I'm guessing you saw a gap, but there must have been, did you feel like you had the support of people to do that as well?
I'm not going to be careful in how I
right, okay, sorry if I'm accidentally
no, it's fine. We started off with a group of people that were also patients themselves in mm-hmm. a support group, in a social media group. That lasted for about a year, and then issues occurred. I'm not going to go into it. And I pulled away from that, and I started again. And rebranding, we kept the name because that was the name that I was associated with in the community. Set up a new website. And I think because of my own networks throughout the rare disease community, I was respected. I'd built these relationships up. I believed that what I was doing, what needs to be done, was the right thing to do. I leaned on the resources out there. So Beacon for Rare Diseases, they were originally called Find a Cure. they ran a lot of training workshops, which I attended, and Genetic Alliance UK ran how to set up a patient organisation, and it was a 12-week session. So I attended that, and they gave me the basic skills to be able to set up and support in ways which I knew needed to happen. I just didn't know how. And even now, to this weekend, the mission statement, the vision statement, our tagline, they've been changed about 10 times because the need of the patients and families has changed. We're seeing a lot more families needing one-to-one support. So we're providing consultations free. We don't charge them. And we go through where they're at this point in their lives, what has gone on before to get to this point. Then we look at, okay, so what are the next steps? Where would they like to be in a year's time, 2 years' time? And sometimes it's about writing a letter to their GP to encourage a referral to a special, like rheumatology or immunology, and educating them, sending them information about the genetic panels that's available. Schools, we have schools that reach out and say, what is this condition that this child has got and how do we help them? You know, not every child will have an educational healthcare plan, because a lot of children only have the medical need. I say only, they have the medical need rather than learning difficulties. But in that, there's a lack of recognition of the emotional and social impact. When children cannot go to school because they are too ill to attend, not only do they miss out on their learning, but they miss out on those really important social interactions with their peers.
Yep.
And when a child goes back into school, you can't just expect them to just go back into the environment. You have to integrate them slowly and recognize that this is going to be really difficult. They might still be feeling really tired, flare up. You know, they've been stuck at home, miserable, in pain. They've probably not slept properly. Now they're expected to be back in school. That they might be excited to see their friends, but they're also really anxious about having to get back.
Can I relate to this? Somebody missed big chunks of school, and especially high school, that fear of going back and dealing with all of the questions, the looks, the comments and whispers, you know, that took me longer to get back than sometimes the actual disability that kept me off in the first place. And I don't know about you, I found that transitions into the workplace as well. Even today, you know, if I go off sick, I probably am 2 or 3 days later going back than I would be, because of that mental battle you then have to get back reacquainted and everything. So yeah, it's a really under discussed topic. So I'm glad you brought that up. I just want to say, yes. So yeah, as somebody that's also gone through a change of direction for what I felt was the right thing to do, and had a lot of headache over that, I totally understand. You know what you went through, and well done for sticking to your guns. But my comment over the community thing was to bring you in, Mark, on, you know, your role as patient. Patient engagement officer. Sorry, I had a mind blank then.
That's right.
It'd be good if you could maybe tell us a little bit about what that involves. But also, I'd love to hear, obviously, it's a really difficult time for charities at the moment, especially here in the UK. I'd love to hear, you know, some of the challenges of that and how you've had to maybe adapt in the role as well. I appreciate you've only been in it a year, but if you could maybe cover that, that'd be great.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a learning curve. So one, I'm not an extrovert, and I have very little marketing experience. So my want to be in this role is more just because I want to help. I know what it's like. I know the benefits of opening up because I've done it myself. And I want to show that to other people, and I want to help. So since I've been in the role, I think our first focus was the World AI Arthritis Day, which didn't get recorded properly, so no one can see that.
Yeah, I was devastated. Yeah, for anyone, our section got completely lost. I did that for 8 to 10 hours, and for anyone sort of watching, and just for context, yeah, the recording was lost. We were passengers in that. We weren't in control of it, but yeah, I was devastated because you guys did brilliantly. And if you ever want to come back on this show for that presentation that you did, I'll happily open the floor for you to do that so you can get the airtime and you you've got the video you can reuse, etc.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. I guess the main thing now is actually trying to get ambassadors on board for the charity, getting them to share their stories. So, you know, we launched an ambassador program in September. We had a big, like a 4-page advert talking about the benefits to not only to us, but to themselves. And, but we appreciate this is a really hard thing to do. That first step to opening up is the hardest step. And it, you know, it's one that I toyed with for a couple of years before I did it. I know that you must have done the same thing. And
yep. Spent about 20 years not wanting to
share. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. especially as men, it's quite, we're not very good at that sort of thing. No, but... So, I mean, as Rachel said, we do a lot of school children. So there's that as well. And we don't expect children to be opening up about that sort of thing and putting themselves in the public domain. We don't ask for any of that. So, you know, we didn't get anyone come forward, but at that point, so we kind of adapted it, made it a bit more specific to one of the conditions we support. We've had someone come forward, which is really nice. They want to write about a family member. So, yeah, we've had to adapt in that kind of way, just trying to, I don't know what the word is, sort of iterate. If that makes sense. Yeah. You know, we found out what's not working, so let's try something else. And that's probably we're going to go from step to step for that way. I'm also looking at raising some funds because we have a website. Rachel and I don't have lots of time to look after it. We don't have web experience. So we're trying to raise some money to try and find someone who can improve the website. Not saying redesign it, but just sort of, you know, in most of it's there, it just needs touching up, that sort of thing. So
yeah,
I'm looking into that as well for Rachel. So yeah, that sort of thing, that's what I'm looking at.
Plenty to keep you busy. But I suppose this is your opportunity to, if anyone listening to this want to get involved, maybe they've got that lived experience or that idea of the ambassador thing appeals to somebody that's an ambassador for an organization. Myself, I know how much that's helped and sort of developed me. Do you want to maybe take the opportunity to sort of talk a little bit more about that, what it involves and how they can maybe reach out and get in touch if they're interested?
Yeah, it can involve many different ways. There's no sort of minimum effort we're expecting, you know, any sort of, you know, even if it's just sort of anonymous blog post, that's fine for us. That's still something, you know, in the future, we'd love to have people go into schools and talk to children and go into hospitals, etc. But we understand this is the very start. We're a very small charity. We're not asking for that right now. We don't offer people money for their time, so we can't expect them to give up loads of time. So, you know, the only thing we're looking for is at the moment really is just to, you know, write about their lived experience. And I can say from my own, from doing it myself through NAS, which is a charity that helps people with me with AS, and doing it from my own blog site, it does help. I guess there's this stigma around having a chronic condition and talking about it, especially pain, and the sort of hidden disability side of things. But I don't think I've had a negative experience from it. Not, you know, I've never had anyone say anything bad towards me. I expect people have, but as a result of doing it, but most of it's been really positive and people really supportive. And actually it's helped them, you know, it's helped educate them about it. So I can only see benefits to doing it really.
It can also be quite therapeutic. I know I often say, like, doing all of this is part of my management. You know, it's my coping technique. You know, the last thing I want to do some Sundays is be on camera in front of people live and all the pressure that brings. But, you know, for the hour I'm doing this and hearing your stories, your experiences, I'm not thinking about my pain or my condition. And it sort of refills your cup a little bit to go again, doesn't it? So it can benefit you. And also it's great for the CV, guys, if anyone's listening for it, you know, and I want to get involved and do a little bit of volunteering. It really does show that other side to you that, you know, when writing your CV. So hopefully someone gets in touch. But where can they find you if you mentioned the website. I have featured on screen. I'll do it again here now. But what about your social media, guys, like in terms of where people can find you there?
RAC UK is the best place to find us. It's the Rare Autoinflammatory Conditions Community on Facebook. There's a little sort of two hands with the love heart in the middle. It's very hard to miss. So yeah, you can find us there. I think someone posted on the chat as well a link to the website, so thank you to
Any other links go in chat, guys, I'll feature them for the people watching this back, so you can see it on screen as well. If you watch this back on YouTube, the chat will still be there, but if you're watching it on Facebook, it won't. So head over to YouTube, guys, if you want to click any of the links that are being featured on screen. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you sharing that. And I appreciate this. Hopefully, though, that having that blank canvas is a challenge. I know what it's like for patient orgs at the minute and everything. But
and we are, I suppose, we do offer help. If people haven't written a blog before but want to, Rachel and I have done it. So, don't worry about that sort of thing. We can proofread, we can offer advice, we can do a video call, all that sort of stuff. So don't worry about any of that. If you want to do it, just get in touch.
Yeah, and you never know where it can lead, guys. That's the thing. Like, I never thought I'd be doing this sort of thing ever. No, look where we are. So thanks, Mark. Rachel, just to sort of bring you in as a sort of final thing, I'd like to sort of like ask you, obviously, you're going to say something, you've come a long way with all of this. What, again, similar to what I said to Mark, like, what are the challenges you're currently facing? And also, like, in terms of forward thinking with the organisation, what are you looking forward to, or what's on the horizon that that hopefully is also a bit of hope as well as the challenges?
So we are developing, the Board of Trustees at the moment are developing a new recruitment pack because, life's changed for people. People haven't got the time that they had to commit to voluntary roles as in the capacity as trustees anymore. So we're trying to encourage others to sign up. We desperately need some trustees that can help improve our organisation. Within the next 2 years, I'd really like to think that we were in a financial position to be able to recruit somebody part-time to help with the administration. Again, that's down to whether we can get the funding. When we say we're a small charity, we're running at £2,000 a year, just core costs. We don't have any other extra costs because we haven't got the income to run extra projects. So everything that we do is virtual. That's also the nature of my condition. I'd like to be able to, bringing Mark in has really helped be able for me to delegate tasks. So even though the ambassadors would be great to be able to, share their lived experience, but if anybody wanted to come in and volunteer for us, whether it's fundraising, helping to recruit for the ambassador program, running our social media accounts, hey Lauren, fundraising, Lauren. Lauren, I'm going to give her a shout out. Her and a friend are going to be doing the 3 Welsh Peaks in 24 hours in May for us.
Oh wow!
And they've very nearly smashed their target of £500 within 14 days.
Unbelievable.
I could cry.
and I think you mentioned about your sort of budget and what you operate on. People don't appreciate that, do they? Don't realise just how small it is for these small charities, especially, and I say in the UK, things have got so much more difficult. As somebody that sort of has a foot in several camps and I end up sort of working on projects with patient orgs and things like that, so you get a bit of insight. You just realise how few and far between them things are and how key them fundraising efforts are, and individuals like Lauren you've mentioned in chat. I absolutely give them a shout out because I realize how important it is for you guys.
I also I'm conscious being a patient myself, having these opportunities to come on here doing the talk shows is great, but I'm also conscious that everything is about my experience, and we want other people to come in and share theirs. It's not just all about me then.
I can absolutely relate to that, Trish. It's the whole reason we do the Chronic Pain Club, because I was so conscious that I said only so many times I could talk about becoming a dad and everything going wrong. And but like I say, it can lose its impact as well, So I started to think, I'm only one voice. I want to be a collector of voices, because then you can do more. Because if you've got that, that that collective experience, then that's when you can really drive change. And so that's why we do what we do here. So absolutely, you guys are welcome back as many times as you'd like to try and help with these. Like I say, if you want to do that presentation again, because it's still, gutted that we lost that recording. For anyone listening, by the way, YouTube has I think it was something like a, was this like 15, 16 hour record limit or something on live streams. And because we were the last leg on a 24 hour stream or something like that, that it meant the entire thing got lost. So if you guys want to come back and do that, and also Rachel, Mark, if you want to send me links to put in a list of links to put in the podcast description when it comes out in a couple of months time, the video, etc., to where people can find you, how they can get involved, especially the ambassador stuff, because I know how important that is to organizations. Absolutely share that for you.
Thank you, Joe. So
yeah, sounds like you've got a lot of busy times ahead, recruiting and finding trustees and everything. I wish you all the best, guys, and I'm really grateful that you joined me on Sunday evening. I appreciate it's in your own time and your weekend, and you're spinning a lot of plates of volunteers and everything already. So thank you so much for joining us, and I know the audience would appreciate it as well.
Well, thank you for having us as well. It's great to have a platform that invites us in.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. I will let you get on now. Just for anyone who's watching this live, or I suppose on rewind, the link to that GoFundMe has been kindly placed in chat by my other half. So guys, if anyone wants to support Lauren and Co's efforts on the fundraising, then you can find that there. Until next time, Rachel, Mark, this won't be the last time we're on the live stream together, I'm sure. We might as well go for the hat trick. thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your weekend, what's left of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Charles. Thanks, everyone.